Some money stories with you. I'm Terry Savage, sitting in today for John Williams on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We have a great hour for you, so be sure to hang in there. In our first half hour, we're going to talk to an expert about what you should do if you have a child going off to college this fall, still making that decision. Maybe there's some financial aid issues now that the family income has been interrupted. So that's coming up in just a bit. And in the second half, you will not want to miss the state of Illinois, the Truth in Accounting report on the true financial state of the state of Illinois with Truth in Accounting Chief Sheila Weinberg. But let me start with some very good news. If you were with us on Friday, we talked with Rebecca Sisco of the Illinois Department of Employment Security, and she promised and she delivered. Earlier this morning, there's a brand new ides.illinois.gov website up, and it's all updated. And click on the box for benefits, and then look for the link. If you are self-employed, look for the link that says PUA. That stands for Pandemic Unemployment Assistance. That is that program for those who are self-employed professionals or, you know, gig workers or whatever, who never had W-2 forms, so didn't qualify for traditional unemployment, but you get it, and you get the federal $600 on top of it. And today is the first day you can register again, ides.illinois.gov. Even, I was a word of caution here, even if you were turned down at the original Illinois site when you tried to file as a self-employed person, you have to start all over again at this new site. So big thanks to Rebecca Sisco and to Deloitte, who put up that great new website. And by the way, they're opening up a new call center, so you should be able to get through more easily. Yes, I know you all have many questions about the unemployment and the certifying and so forth. Could you give it just this week before you swamp me again and keep trying? Because I think they've got it set up better now. Later on at the end of the show, I hope I'll have a few minutes to talk about my latest newsletter, wondering how both unemployment and stocks could be soaring at the same time. I'll try and take some questions at the end. But for our first guest, we're going to open up the phone lines now. For those who have questions related to college, student financial aid, all the things that have changed for this term because of this whole slowdown, the close down of the economy. So for those, the phone line is open, 312-981-7200. While I introduce a guest who's become kind of a friend of mine over the last few years, as I've written columns, there's one a new column up today at terrysavage.com. Casey Neer is Executive Director of Counseling at CollegeWise. It's collegewise.com is where you can find her. CollegeWise is a national network of accredited college counselors who work with students, families, and with their high school counselors to advise on college choice, help with applications, discuss things like affordability and aid, and help in general guide decision-making. It's your private advisor. There are a bunch of independent and accredited counselors, and Casey is on the front lines. Just what's happening now as colleges are deciding when and how to open, whether they're going to open dormitories or just offer online or distance learning, and that brings up a lot of questions. So Casey Neer from CollegeWise, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thank you for having me, Terry.
Well, this column I wrote that you helped me write, I should say, this morning, mm-hmm. attracted a lot of attention already. Let me just start out with, what, because of all this, what has happened to that May 1st deadline, which was like the most critical moment? You had mm-hmm. probably been accepted in April, and now on May 1st you had to tell one school that you were going and put up a deposit of a few hundred dollars. That's coming on, right?
Yeah, I mean, May 1st on, you know, Friday is traditionally this sacred, celebratory, happy time for college seniors. You know, they're eyeing their prom and their graduation, and they make this final decision for colleges. And as we all well know, all of that has been upended. And I think what folks don't realize is that, you know, 400 or so colleges have officially shifted what had been this kind of sacred deadline that colleges band together around May 1st and transitioned it to June 1st and said, you know what, it's not fair for us to ask you to make a decision when we haven't made a decision about the fall. So we're going to give you more time. Now, not all colleges have, because there's over 2,300 and only 400 have said that. But we are seeing colleges grant more extensions and flexibility as students are weighing their options without the full picture.
That's the question. Let's switch to the college side of it, because how could you make a decision without the full picture? What are you seeing out there? Obviously it changes day by day as different schools decide when and how they're going to open.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone's using this analogy these days, but everyone's trying to build the plane while they fly it. I mean, colleges are still trying to finish out this semester with their students, let alone figure out what next semester will look like, while also trying to get deposits and tuition from students without that full picture. And so far, to be honest, what I'm seeing is a lot of student-centered, creative approaches. I think they're trying to dexterously balance that whole what's safe, what's good for our students, and what still gets them an education. And every single state, you know, we talk about this is a global problem with local solutions. Every single one of those thousands of colleges is going to tackle this differently.
Now, this is interesting. So we'll come to the financial part of it in a bit. But
yeah,
if you can go, your parents had enough in your college savings account, but you just, you know, you might not want to go. Do you have to say by now even June 1st? Well, what should you do now? You haven't heard from your school. You've already missed the May 1st deadline. Are you supposed to be calling in and saying, how late can I let you know? I'm a little scared to go myself, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody, I know some folks have their own health concerns. I know some students feel like there's no way that I could physically go, you know, in the fall, or they're weighing, I don't know if we can afford to go. So I think everybody needs to first step, talk to the school that you're considering. Maybe you've already deposited, maybe you're weighing two choices before June 1st and see what they're deciding. Colleges, I'm hopeful, are being communicative about what their plans or thoughts are for the fall. But I think also seeing what extensions there might be.
Communication.
Communication is really key. And I think that's important for students. If you're admitted to the school, you're in the driver's seat. You know, you're not an applicant anymore. You're a student who's been admitted. That means they want you. So
stop right there for one second, Casey, and let me do two things. Let me mention that our phone lines are open if you have calls for Casey Neers of College Wise, Casey Neer. All right. When we left, Casey Neer of College Wise, you were saying that students are a bit in the driver's seat. Let's see if that applies to money. A lot of high school seniors who are headed off to college are a little bit worried that the families are worried. Mom's lost a job, dad's lost a job. What advice do you give them?
Yeah, I think so. First off, if you have suffered, as many obviously are and have right now, that's something that you should and can present to the college. So if you're into a school and you have your financial aid package, but someone lost a job, someone is sick, someone is newly on disability, those are all updates that you're going to want to share with the college financial aid office, not the admissions office anymore, but financial aid, to see if you can get an increased aid offer. So that's the first step that you want to do. But then some students are realizing that maybe what that college is capable of isn't ever going to be enough. You know, they're not going to be able to cover the whole cost. And maybe your finances have changed so much that you're needing to find a significantly cheaper school. So the other option I would say is there are over 700 schools still accepting applications for the fall. And so there may be a school that's in state or has a lower base cost that you might want to consider right now. But I think first step is if you're into a school and you can present information, do it and see what you might get.
If you're applying to a new school, suddenly you're going to go to the state school or a local college, it's not too late to file FAFSA, is it? Especially when you have a financial circumstance change.
Exactly. And colleges, they want to educate you. You know, I think we make them out to be these enemies, but really they are really wanting students right now. I think every college is going to handle it differently, how much aid they're able to provide. But certainly looking at costs, the schools that have lower cost of attendance overall, maybe places that are closer to home for anybody who's eyeing their finances and feeling wary, certainly something to consider. But I think first step is seeing if you can renegotiate aid at where you're already in.
Great advice. We have a caller on the line. Barbara, what's your question?
I have a question about my son is a transfer student, and he's going to have to look for apartments, but we're wary to sign a lease before we know if it's going to be on school learning or not.
Yeah. The honest answer is everyone is waiting to see if it's going to be online or not. I think it depends on where he's considering. I'm obviously pretty mindful of any urban schools, certainly in New York, Boston, LA areas. I'm pretty skeptical about those places going in person in the fall. Go for it.
All right. Let me press you a little bit on that, Casey. You know, you talked about getting colleges, maybe the prestige one that you got into, but you can't afford now. Can you accept two colleges and wait and see what happens?
You cannot. So it's a good question. So for students right
How
now,
they
and
know?
I think this is the Yeah, well, so there's a lot of different ways. It's part of our professional code of conduct. And basically the school counselor, and this isn't true for a transfer student, but would be true for a high school student, say, where the school counselor is eventually going to need to send a final transcript. And they are in their full right to only send one final transcript to the college that you are choosing to attend. I think the hard part right now, like I said at the beginning, is right now we're forcing kids to decide before colleges have. And so that's where I would have students say, can I request an extension rather than deposit it to places? Now, one caveat of this is you can absolutely accept to be on the wait list. So say I'm at the wait list, on the wait list at X university, waiting to hear if I get off of it, and I've deposited at another one, that's totally fine. But you can't have two active deposits at two places.
And when you get off the wait list, first of all, I should have said thank you to Barbara for her question. I guess everybody is going, you first, you first, you first. So let's talk about this wait list. You know, you've been on the wait list for that prestige school. Suddenly the prestige expensive school goes, oops, we might not fill our class, even though we're the famous, you know, college or university. And so are they accepting more now off their wait list? And how long do you have to say, to figure out the finances when they accept you? Do they give you a very much more generous financial offer?
So the honest answer is not really a generous offer necessarily, and usually a quick turnaround. So they usually will accept folks off a wait list and ask for 48 hours, sometimes a day, sometimes a few days to make a decision, which frankly puts a lot of pressure on students. I've seen schools say, I give you a day after you get your financial aid package to make a choice. I certainly push on students to ask for any extensions they can, because frankly, it's pretty impossible to make a choice in 24 hours. But I haven't always seen colleges grant those. So I think for anybody eyeing a wait list, it's good to be prepared that you may have to make a pretty quick decision when it comes to which school to deposit at.
That's really interesting. I would think that colleges would be a little bit more humble. I've seen studies that there's so many families who are literally saying to their children, you know, I don't think we can afford it. Maybe you should take a gap year. You and I talked about this in my column. I loved what you had to say about a gap year.
Yeah, well, and I think, so obviously, if you're saying, I can't afford this, I need to get a paid job or help me support my family and kind of recoup our losses and try and go to school in a year, totally understandable. I think what I'm hearing a lot of students, though, is having this kind of false hypothetical, right? Of either I get to go to my top choice school in person, and if I don't do that and it has to be online, then I want to do this cool, interesting thing that's door number two, right? And I think the reality is we all know that if your school is going to be online in the fall, it's probably likely that there's not going to be an exciting door number two option. I think part-time jobs are going to be really hard to come by. If you're in your 40s, let alone you're a 17-year-old out of high school, it's probably that you can't do a fun travel gap year for kids who are thinking maybe I'll go volunteer or do kind of other things abroad. That's going to be really unlikely. So I think the hard part I'm seeing students come to terms with is maybe door number two isn't as interesting as I thought it was. And I think if you're considering door number two, it's going to likely be local. You know, what are things you can do locally? Get a job, take community college courses. And I will say on that, for students who are thinking about cost and thinking, I'll just defer a year at that state school for your college and start taking classes locally, you really, really want to look at the fine print there, because oftentimes if you're starting to take classes and accruing credits, you're then counted as a transfer student. And then you may have to reapply, actually, to that school as a transfer student down the line. So a lot of
that could create a big problem. So are there any schools that where you could call them up and say, look, you know, you're online. Mm-hmm. I want to live at home and do it in a community college. Will you write it down that I can get in January or a year from now? Are any schools granting that delay or deferment? If you take classes?
Some schools. Yeah, some dual schools are already coming out, but it's frankly the outliers at this point. So Michigan State came out and said that we'll consider you if you want to take classes closer to home for the first year and then come to us. We'll consider you not having to reapply. But honestly, a lot of colleges are still figuring out what they want to do with this policy, because it has been, like May 1st, a bit of a sacred thing. But if you start taking classes, you're immediately a transfer student. But we're hearing more and more students thinking, maybe I want to stay home. Now, again, considering if you're staying home, going to a local community college, that community college might also be online too. So again, thinking about what experience is it that I'm wanting, and will staying at home be all that different? I think that's important for everybody to think about right now.
Well, that's a tough decision. I just heard from my college, off to college students, Peyton and Emmy, who are twins, who are daughters of a good friend of mine, Alicia, and they are, you know, they're anxious to get down to Indiana University, but their mom said, you know, they raised tuition 3.4%. That's astounding. Mm-hmm. I thought colleges would be cutting deals now and lowering tuition.
I would have hoped so. Let's put it that way. But no, we've seen, you know, UC Berkeley, one of the UCs, has put out a statement to say they're going to keep tuition costs steady for the fall, even if they are going to be online. And I think what we're seeing is that these are large institutions. These are large businesses. And yes, they're trying to be student-centered and student-focused, but they also need to keep revenue costs. And we're seeing, you know, there's going to be report after report in the next few weeks and months of what revenue losses colleges are going to be seeing because of tuition cuts, because of not getting room and board for this past fall, for this past spring, sorry. And what they do next is really going to see who is going to make or break, frankly. The colleges, I think, that are creative, that are student-focused, like you said, Terry, are they actually helping students? I think they're going to be the ones that survive, because I think that's the hard part, is we're likely going to see colleges closing because of this, too.
So this is good. This is a real time of change. You've got a great perspective. So let me just hit you with this one last question. Let's talk about contemplating the value for your education dollar. Has that formula changed now? Would you tell people, you got to admit it at Harvard or Princeton or someplace that's fabulous, but you're going to be online, maybe don't want to do that. What's the value for the dollar proposition?
Yeah, I mean, I think I always love to talk about cost versus value when it comes to college price. And I think oftentimes, you know, we understandably in America, we love our brands. And there are college brands just as much as there are clothing brands, right? And we tend to say, well, I'll pay top dollar for that higher brand name. But study after study shows it's so much more about what you do when you get to college, what you make of that four-year experience than the name on that diploma.
Wise words from someone who sees it with a great perspective. our guest Casey Neer. Go to collegewise.com, learn about them. It is not too late to sign up to get some advice. It doesn't have to be the whole admissions process, but from the professionals at CollegeWise. Thanks so much, Casey Neer, for joining us. And now we're going to swing it to Steve Bertrand for a look at the news. Hello and welcome back to the Wind Trust Business Lunch. I'm Terry Savage, sitting in today for John Williams. You know, if you were watching us last Friday, you heard Ed Wehmer of Wind Trust talking about the fact that Illinois has got a big financial problem. The woman who knows most about the Illinois financial problem is our guest on this segment. We'll keep the phone lines open, 312-981-7200. But let me just set you up with a few facts from truthinaccounting.org's report just released. It says, think about this in terms of your own budget, because these eyes kind of make your MIGO numbers, my eyes glaze over. The report says Illinois has $28.5 billion available to pay $254.5 billion worth of bills. That's a headline. The outcome is a $226 billion shortfall, and that is before you take into effect the coronavirus costs. Now let me introduce Sheila Weinberg, founder of truthinaccounting.org. It's a nonprofit dedicated to ferreting out the real numbers hidden across the country in state and local budgets. But they're based here in Illinois, and they've been keeping a sharp focus on our state. By the way, I should fully disclose, I'm listed on their honorary advisory board because they've been supplying me with good stuff for a long, long time. And just 2 days ago, they released this new report on the financial state of Illinois with those numbers. Sheila Weinberg, welcome. Wait a minute. I thought we had a balanced budget.
Yeah, the governor, every press conference, gets asked about a balanced budget, and he said, yes, we have, on Face the Nation. Last Sunday, he went and said, hey, you know, we were in fine financial shape. We were on the way to a balanced budget, but it all depends on how you calculate a balanced budget. And he did it by not funding the pensions properly. To bring that to people's minds, it's like me saying, hey, Terry, I balanced my budget, but I didn't pay even the minimum on my credit cards. And he didn't pay the minimum into the pension plans, but he's claiming this balanced budget.
Now, also on this report, again, these numbers are just mind-boggling, so just remember these two. The unfunded pension benefits are $144 billion, $161 million. Let's start with $144 billion, a round number. And the unfunded retiree health care benefits, promises we've made, I guess, to state workers are covered by state health care, $56 billion. So, you know, you're way up there, a couple hundred. I mean, tell me about this.
Yeah, well, what the politicians do is they calculate this balanced budget on the cash basis, so they only have to include the checks they write. And when employees wanted additional compensation, they said, well, if we increase their salaries, we're going to have to increase their paychecks, and then the budget won't be balanced. So let's go ahead and offer them pensions and retiree health care benefits. Those don't have to be paid for decades to come. And so when the employees earned those benefits, instead of setting money aside to fund those, they went ahead and spent that money on other things and left the pensions and health care benefits unfunded.
If you were a big corporation, now most corporations 20, 30 years ago saw this issue, a lot of retirees, and so they converted at some point to something what we now know as 401k plans or 403b plans for nonprofits and so forth. But if a company today, a big company, a New York Stock Exchange listed big company, had a pension plan, and some still do, and they were so underfunded, what would happen to them?
Well, they would be, you know, the executives would be going to jail. At a minimum, you know, once the plans get funded under 80%, they have, you know, those corporations have to have a plan to get them out of that underfundedness. And I'm looking on our website, Illinois' unfunded pension liability, and on our Data Z website, and they're 39% funded. The IRS would, you know, and the federal government would come in and take over those corporations or require them to have a plan to fund those. They wouldn't let them increase the benefits. And they would make the corporation pay more into contributions. But instead, the state of Illinois doesn't have to follow those rules, and they can pretty much put in anything they want to. And then, again, they still claim a balanced budget.
Yeah. All right. Now, look, truthinaccounting.org, the reason I love them, they're apolitical. And I think you'd be the first to say this has happened under both Democrat and Republican governors.
Yeah, this, you know, part of this huge pension mess started under the Edgar administration when they set up a pension scheme to fund the pension plan, 90% over 50 years. Well, the SEC, when they included that, hey, our plans are going to be funded 90% over 50 years in the bond offerings, the SEC charged the state with securities fraud, saying that plan, there's no way mathematically that that funds the pensions 90% over 50 years. So, yeah, it's been under, you know, Republican administrations and Democratic administrations.
All right. Now, here's what we know and what we don't think about. At least the federal government adding $4 trillion, you know, a trillion here, a trillion there, of Dirksen is rolling in his grave. Pretty soon a trillion here and there, it's real money. But at least the federal government can print the money. Now, a state government can't do that. So, and the state government's not legally allowed to go bankrupt either. And our state government constitution says you cannot change the pension benefits or how they're handed out. So what's going to happen?
Yeah, but the state budget also, the state constitution also says you have to balance budget. The state constitution also says the foremost thing that you need to do for the state is for the citizens is to provide them with prosperity and safety. Well, we're not living up to that claim. So why does this pension clause get higher ranking than any of these other important clauses?
Because the legislators get pensions and they vote on it. Am I wrong?
They get pensions, and also a lot of their campaign contributions come to union from public employee unions, who obviously are supporting these type of pension plans. And you know, obviously, this has set up the state for disaster.
Now, it's been, you know, it's become a sort of a political football in Washington. Even in Illinois, is, you know, the name has come up. We're not bailing out. We might help you. And again, let's stay apolitical. We might help you because you have these expenses from the pandemic, but we're not going to bail out your underfunded pension fund. I don't know that the Democrats have enough clout and votes in Washington to fix that at this point. But the question is there a way even that you think the federal government could fix it if they did have the vote? I guess they could print the money.
Well, I think, you know, they're going to print the money. Well, in the case of the Federal Reserve will print the money. The Treasury, if the Congress does do a bailout for the states, Treasury will borrow the money. And if they do that, we think there should be strings attached to that. You know, again, if you have a bankruptcy, in essence, that's what you're saying here, the court would require you to have a plan. Well, Congress, if you're going to bail out these state and local governments, get a plan, make them create a plan to get their fiscal imbalances straightened out and to get them to properly fund their pensions. Don't just give them money and then, you know, they're going to create the same, use that money and still continue to have the same problems they've had in the past.
So this is a tough one. We're, again, apolitical. We're talking accounting. The website is truthinaccounting.org. Is there any way to avoid tax increases, which makes the state very inhospitable to live? I'm talking about either property taxes, income taxes, graduated taxes. Leave aside the political doability of it. Is there any way in the world to avoid tax increases?
Well, as you mentioned, you know, we're $226 billion in the hole. The only way to fix that is to bring more money in, which some people think the progressive income tax would. Some people think that would cause more people to move out of the state, so it wouldn't bring more money in. Or you have to cut expenses. And, you know, pensions probably have to be on there because those are the biggest debt that you have.
Do you, just from the truth in accounting viewpoint, do you ever foresee the political will to adjust pensions, if not for those who are already receiving them, but for those who are either currently working or to add on? I mean, no, there have been many proposals to add on a 401k and wean people off the pensions and so forth, and they were non-starters because of the constitutional issue. Is there? Do you see that becoming a?
Well, they have
reality?
Slowly, with new employees, offered to got put more of them on a 401k type package. Have less benefits. But again, as you mentioned, they're $144 billion in the hole. Those aren't future pensions. Those are ones that are already incurred that theoretically under this constitutional requirement cannot be changed. It's interesting that, the current, the next ballot will have a constitutional amendment to change from a flat tax to progressive income tax. But there's nothing on there to change the structural problems that got us into this mess, i.e., change the pensions, maybe redistricting. None of those issues are on the ballot, just an additional progressive income tax.
All right, so these are the facts. I know a lot of I can hear a lot of people's toes curling out there thinking, wait, this is not right. I will have to tell you, about 15 years ago, when we first met, I wrote a column called The Coming Pension Wars, and I noted that we require our police and fire, at the time anyway, to live in the city of Chicago, and that it was going to be very difficult because you would pay their pensions, but their property taxes on their bungalows would go up, so it would go in one pocket and out the other in order to pay those pensions. People wrote in and said, that's terrible, they'll never not pay the pensions. And I think people are still saying that. And in a way, it's unfair to have promised that. But, I don't see a better way out either, do you?
No, and one suggestion that they're doing right now is something people need to be aware of re-amortizing, which sounds kind of innocuous. It's like, oh, yeah, they'll re-amortize it. And what that means is, I have credit card debt. The minimum payment is $1,000 a month. I don't like paying that. So I call the credit card company and say, well, instead of paying this off over 60 months, go ahead and extend that to 120 months. So my monthly payment is less. It doesn't get rid of the debt. It doesn't fix anything. It just pushes it off. And that is, quote, one of the big fixes I project is coming down the pike, that they're going to, fixes. I put big quotes around that. That does nothing to fix the pensions. It just kicks the can further down the road.
Well, the question is, how far can you kick it? In our last minute that we have, you also look at the whole country. Is there any place as horrible a fix as Illinois?
We do rank New Jersey as the absolute worst state, but they might account for their pensions a little bit better than we do. So Illinois is probably right up there with them. But New Jersey, Illinois, Connecticut, Hawaii, those states are all in bad shape. We did have sunshine states, Alaska, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, where they were ahead of the game before this crisis. But keep in mind, none of the states had what you recommend, chicken money, to weather this storm. And now they're going to the federal government saying, you need to bail us out. Well, maybe they should have had chicken money set aside. Illinois had $100 million, which is less than one day's worth of expenses. Maybe they should have had chicken money so they didn't have to go to Washington begging for a bailout.
Here we go again. One of the best things, by the way, Sheila, of the Truth in Accounting, truthinaccounting.org website, is there is a national debt clock. It ticks minute by minute. And it has not only the U.S. published national debt, which is now over $25 trillion, but it has Truth in Accounting's estimate of what the real debt is in terms of all those future promises to pay retirement benefits and health benefits and military benefits that the federal government has made. It's a wonderful site. Sheila Weinberg, you do a great job in keeping track of the real numbers. Thank you for joining us today. And let's go back to Steve Bertrand for the Wintrust Business Minute.
Wind the clock. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, your daily roundup of Chicago area business news. It's been bleak for Boeing these days, but here's some good news. Crane says United, Southwest, and American Airlines will take delivery of 151 planes by the end of next year. Boeing can use that revenue. Digital Mint, a Chicago startup making it easier to buy Bitcoin through ATMs, is expanding through the U.S. as it works to make owning cryptocurrency more accessible. Chicago Inno says Digital Mint has more than 350 Bitcoin ATMs and teller locations in 26 states. And Chicago may be the third most populous city in the U.S., but when it comes to the highest cost of living. It doesn't even crack the top 10. It's number 15. Move.org looked at the numbers. It says Chicago comes in at 15 with average monthly expenses at about $2,500 a month. That's just under Miami and just above Santa Ana, California. I'm Steve Bertrand. That's the Wintrust Business Minute.
The Dow has been on either side of the positive sign. It's eke a gain now of just a quarter of a point. The NASDAQ leading the way up 94 and the S&P 500 up 10. Let's get a look at the agribusiness headlines now. Orion Samuelson.
And today, more information on what's going to happen to county fairs and state fairs in the state of Illinois. Stan Eden of Extension Partners forwarded to me a letter from the 4-H leadership at the University of Illinois, and pay attention because you'll want to know where to go to get more information more than likely. All in-person events sponsored by Illinois Extension through July 5 have been canceled or transitioned to an online delivery format, and 4-H shows scheduled from now through July 5th have been transitioned to online virtual showing. And according to the university office, we'll be getting updates the 1st and the 15th of every month from now through August 1st to keep us posted on what fairs and events are scheduled, where, and when. So check with your 4-H Club office to make sure you know what's expected of you if you're going to try to show livestock at the county and state fairs. The virtual system will be used to judge livestock, and that's pretty unusual, but you're going to have to probably learn how to become good TV cameramen to shoot the video of your animal that you would normally take into the show ring, but now will be judged on videotape. We had one experience of that a couple of weeks ago in Arizona. Their county fair season is earlier than ours, certainly, and they were holding a county fair, and they were doing it by the virtual system where the 4-H Club and livestock members who were planning to show shot TV of their animal and submitted it to an office where a judge sitting in California watching television did the judging to pick the champion and grand champion. No question, the 4-H fair season is going to look a little, maybe a big different than it usually does because of the COVID-19 situation. But as far as the other activity, yeah, we're continuing to plant, and that sounds like the weather will give us an opportunity to do that the first part of the week. But we'll get that report this afternoon from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. That's your money on 720 WGN.
And welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Terry Savage, sitting in today for John Williams. I love being the host of the show. I sometimes love being the guest, too, which I usually do on Wednesdays. So let me take a minute while I open our phone lines and let our producer, Pete, answer your calls. The phone lines 312-981-7200. We'll see if I can take a few calls here. You can go to terrysavage.com and read my latest columns, which appear Monday in the Chicago Tribune, and get my newsletter. It's free. You can just sign up in the box, or I always post that after I've sent it out. And the one I sent out last night was headlined, Unemployment Soars and Stocks Rise. How could that possibly be? A lot of people have asked me that question, and I have to say, honestly, the glib answer is, well, the market is looking beyond the economic disruption that we have now and looking toward the reopening and figuring out things will be soaring again. And part of that is, of course, the Fed's printed so much money. The first rule of investing is never fight the Fed. And the Fed has made it quite clear that it's not letting things go down the tubes. So that's what those who are looking forward to the stock market rally, and we've actually seen the market bounce off its lows of March 23rd when the Dow was 18,213. Just for remembering, the peak was in January at 29,568. So we're back around 24,000 now. Come as a skeptic, or maybe it's my stage of life, I believe in America for the long run, so if you're in your 20s and 30s, keep putting that 401k money away. We will survive this. But if you're wondering whether I get back in now, I don't like to time the market, and I don't believe that this market has discounted all the pain in the economy. Read that column. Read down to the kinds of questions I've been getting. My TerrySavage.com blog went viral again. Turns out the IRS handed out stimulus checks to people on SSI, but did not hand them out to the children they registered. There's a lot of pain out there. A lot of people waiting to get their unemployment benefits that deserve them. A lot of restaurants and retailers that may not open up again. I want it to work out. Boy, I want to get back out there, and I want our economy to work out. But I think I still need some, a lot more than usual chicken money on the sideline. Okay, so I know we have some calls, Pete. I'm sorry, Myrna. Okay, Myrna.
Okay, I'm kind of hard of hearing, so bear with me, please. excuse me. I'm calling about my grandson. He's 19 years old, be 20 this month. He's a full-time student, and when his parents went to file income tax this year, they were told by the tax preparer that they couldn't claim his him as a dependent. And so he did earn some money on a part-time job, and she said he had to file separately. Well, that's what he did, and so they don't have the money, or that they weren't permitted the deduction for his
great.
And
Myrna, that's great news. You know why? If he were over 17 and a dependent on his parents' return, they could not collect $500 for him. But because he was independent and filed a tax return, he should look for his $1,200 stimulus payment to come to the mailing address on his tax return.
He should get one, you said.
Oh, yes, he should, as long as he was not declared a dependent on his parents' return. And people didn't know this whole thing was coming with stimulus payments. And a lot of people, of course, their college kids are dependent on them. The tax preparer said, no, you can't claim him as a dependent, and he made some money. So it worked out just very well for them. A lot of people wish they could, you know, could take it back, take their kids off and let them get the benefit. But thanks for calling. That's a really good question. Peter, we got anybody else waiting on the line?
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Myrna, for calling in. We got probably not enough time for another question, so let's just leave it at this. I'm swamped at TerrySavage.com. Please read the columns that are there. Please, if you have a question, you could post it on my blog. I'm staying up very late at night. I'm bullish on America. I believe, despite my concerns about the stock market from here, that we will get through this. We all have to be part of this together, though. I'm honored to sit here and fill in for John Williams on the Wintrust Business Lunch, and I'll be back as his guest on Wednesday, so maybe that'll be a chance to answer more questions.